Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Certain chemicals that are added to food and used in food packaging could be harmful, and children may be most at risk. That's according to a new report from the American Academy of Pediatrics, which highlighted five chemical groups to watch out for at the grocery store, among other things. Associate Editor of Health and Food for Consumer Reports, Julia Calderon, recently wrote about the issue and how to keep kids safe. We'll post a link to her article at WOSU.org/allsides. Julia Calderon joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
What triggered the report in the first place?
So basically, there's thousands of chemicals that are added to our foods, and certain experts are concerned that there's simply not enough evidence to prove that they're safe. So chemicals like BPA, phthalates, PFCs, which are found in wrappers and packaging, nitrates and nitrites, which are curing agents in some foods. What they want to do is raise awareness about these chemicals and highlight some ways that consumers can reduce their risk.
It seems like the role of the Food and Drug Administration.
Exactly. So a lot of these chemicals have not been rigorously tested for safety, unlike other, you know, things that are on the market that the FDA approves. And so a lot of these chemicals are under a designation called GRAS, which is generally recognized as safe. And they basically aren't tested for safety as rigorously as others.
Why are children at higher risk?
Children are still developing. You know, their organ systems are still developing, their brains are still developing. And so with some of these chemicals, they've been found to cause a suite of health problems, which include developmental and reproductive harms, obesity, thyroid hormone disruption, even cancer. And so it's believed that children may be most vulnerable to these effects.
You wrote that it is still an open question exactly how harmful some of these chemicals may be for children. Why is that an open question? Just because they haven't been studied?
Exactly. Yeah, just more research is needed. We know that a lot of these chemicals are linked to a lot of these problems, but we haven't proven that they cause these problems or even what levels is the most concerning. You know, we're exposed to these chemicals on a daily basis. It's in our food. It's in our personal care products. It's in food packaging. We don't know exactly what concentration of these chemicals are getting into our bodies and what that's actually doing to the body.
The report highlighted five chemical groups of concern. Can you give us a little thumbnail about them?
So BPA is one of them. The two most concerning are BPA and phthalates. Both of those are in plastics. BPA also lines metal cans. Phthalates are in plastics to make them soft. Other ones are called PFCs. Those are perfluoroalkyl chemicals, and those are found in greaseproof wrappers and packaging, things like, you know, when you get fast food and your fries come in those cardboard sleeves that has PFCs. Perchlorate is another one that's also found in food packaging. And then nitrates and nitrites, which are found in, you know, like hot dogs, cured meats, those kinds of things.
Nitrates are a preservative?
Yes, preservative.
The food packaging, it's not just stuff we get at the grocery store now. It's from fast food places. Where else would we come across these things?
So fast food restaurants is a big one. Things that are wrapped in plastic. So, you know, if you go in the grocery store and you get produce, for instance, that's already pre-cut and they're in those clamshell containers or even wrapped with saran wrap, those things. They're also found in just takeout containers. Anything that has a plastic component to it, you're going to find these chemicals in.
Even the bags you use in the produce section?
Yep, even the bags should have them.
This is not new. These things have been around for a really long time now.
Yes, it's not new. They've been around for a long time. But it's really only the past about two decades of research that has been linking them to health products. And so that's exactly why we just don't have enough data to know how harmful they are to our health.
What are your, well, first of all, you're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking about the results of a new study that showed that certain chemicals that are added to food and used in food packaging could be harmful and that children may be most at risk. It's a report from the American Academy of Pediatrics. It highlighted the five chemical groups. And my guest, Associate Editor of Health and Food for Consumer Reports, Julia Calderon, recently wrote about it, and she just did a little thumbnail sketch of each of these chemicals. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It seems strange, out of all the things that the FDA studies and that we have to wait, particularly when it comes to things like drugs and that, that they don't seem to be that interested in things like this, things that we wrap our foods in. How has the FDA responded to this?
You know, I think the FDA, they know that they need to focus on this more. But I think, you know, it's a question of resources and how much, you know, how much time they have to look into this. It's a lot, you know, there's a lot of food products that are on the market. And so it's a really big undertaking. A lot of these chemicals were put into place decades ago, you know, before the FDA was maybe like more rigorous about certain things. So, you know, it's a lot of these chemicals have been grandfathered in, and we just don't have the studies on them to know how safe they are. And that's a big point that the researchers are making here, is that, you know, they're not necessarily saying that these chemicals are definitely harmful, but we also don't know that they're safe. You know, there haven't been these studies to show that they're safe.
What are the suspicions about what kind of damage these chemicals could do, how they could harm us?
Yeah, so, you know, they're linked to a range of health problems, and some chemicals have more evidence of harm than others. As I said, you know, BPA and phthalates have the most evidence. BPA and phthalates have been linked to developmental and reproductive harms, also obesity. The perchlorate, which is, you know, mixed into packaging, and the nitrates and nitrites, which are the preservatives, those have been linked to thyroid hormone disruption, and the nitrates and nitrites have also been linked to cancer. So, you know, it's a really big sweep of potential issues.
Let's talk about some strategies for avoiding these products. Tell us what Consumer Reports recommends.
Sure. So, you know, these chemicals, like I said, are everywhere. They're in dust. They're in, you know, your food packaging. They're in personal care products like lotion. So it's impossible to avoid them completely. But there are some things you can do to reduce your exposure. So one of those is, you know, focus on whole fruits and vegetables. If you buy your fruits fresh or frozen, as opposed to canned or packaged or processed, like I said, you know, when they're sliced, pre-sliced into mm-hmm. packages, that can greatly minimize your exposure to BPA from the can, and then also phthalates from the packaged and processed food. It's also a healthier way to get your nutrients anyways. Another thing is just to be cautious with the plastic products that you're using. So some of the most concerning chemicals that are listed in this report are mixed into plastic containers, food wrappers, packaging. So if you reuse them, like when they're heated or if they contain hot liquids, those chemicals can leach into your foods and drinks. So make sure not to reheat things in Tupperware or plastic containers, and you should try to use glass and stainless steel whenever you can, as opposed to plastic. Another thing is avoiding processed meats. You know, there's been past studies that have linked people who consume these extremely processed foods like hot dogs, chicken nuggets, those kinds of things. Those have been linked to obesity, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. And then also, you know, those processed meats contain these preservatives, these nitrates and nitrites, and those have been linked to cancer. And then another thing is also just make sure you're reading labels. You know, even some labels that say no nitrates or nitrites added, mm-hmm. they may still contain them. They may have non-synthetic sources such as celery juice or celery powder, and those can be just as harmful.
Why is that?
So basically, those are, it's what manufacturers say as a natural source of nitrates and nitrites, and they, you know, it it's supposed to mean that they're not as harmful, but they can actually react with certain compounds to produce those. They're called nitrosamines. That's what's linked to cancer. So basically, if you see a label that says no nitrates or nitrates or nitrites added, mm-hmm. If there is a disclaimer that says except for those occurring naturally in, and then whatever they use, such as celery powder or celery juice, that means you can't be sure that it's completely free of nitrates or nitrites.
But if they occur naturally, that's not anything. That doesn't matter anyway.
Exactly. The word natural does not mean anything.
And then I'm kind of intrigued by the idea that those thin plastic bags at the grocery stores in the produce section. Now, I try to avoid them anyway because of the waste issue of it. But you're saying that those include some of these chemicals as well.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, another good strategy is to, after you're handling things that are plastic, like those plastic bags or your produce is in there, make sure that you're washing both your hands and whatever has touched the plastic. So if you got a bunch of apples, make sure you wash them carefully. There have actually been some studies that have shown that using a baking powder solution can remove some of, not only the pesticides, but what other residues, these additives that are on them.
Maybe just avoid using them at all. Just start using your grocery bags that you bring into the store to carry stuff like that.
Yeah,
to the checkout. Yeah,
It's definitely better for the environment too, and could be potentially better for your health.
Hmm. Well, Julia Calderon, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Ann.
Julia Calderon, she is Associate Editor of Health and Food for Consumer Reports. She recently wrote about a new report from the American Academy of Pediatrics that highlighted 5 chemical groups to watch out for at the grocery store, at fast food places, and how to keep kids safe especially. So check out the link. We'll post it at the website at wosu.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention this month released guidelines on diagnosing and managing head injuries in children. We'll post a link to the guidelines at wosu.org/allsides. This is important because it's the first time the CDC has written guidelines specific to brain injuries in kids. The lead author is pediatric emergency medicine specialist and co-director of the Stanford Concussion and Brain Performance Center, Dr. Angela Lumba Brown. Dr. Lumba Brown joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So why now for the CDC guidelines?
Well, the guidelines have actually been a work in progress for years. There was a call to action from Congress for the CDC to weigh in on safety and evidence supporting the diagnosis, management, and prognosis of mild traumatic brain injury in children. We established a large work group of multidisciplinary experts, including neurologists, neurosurgeons, emergency medicine clinicians, neuropsychologists, physical therapists, and even previous patients of concussion, to move forward in developing evidence that could give us an answer for how to best direct our clinicians to care for children.
Why are children so different from adults?
It's not that children are necessarily so different from adults, but they do have differences in the way their body is made up that could put them at more risk. And those differences include a larger head-to-body ratio, less neck strength, and less musculature in their body that would cause them to have less of an ability to absorb impact. They also have developing brains all the way through the age of 21, 22. Your brain is developing, undergoing changes of neuronal pruning, establishing those important connections. And that could also be a risk for them because we don't fully understand how an injury in this particular period of development could affect your future. And then finally, as we all know, children are inherent risk takers, jumping off couches and playground equipment. And that also puts them at a higher risk for injury because compared to adult counterparts, we're not usually doing things like that.
How are the guidelines determined? You mentioned the disciplines involved in it, but what were the factors that went into determining what the guidelines should be?
This was a highly regimented process. It followed methodology from the American Academy of Neurology. In assembling the group, all the experts were vetted. We, as a group, decided which topic areas we felt were most important to focus on. And that process was a voting process. That then followed by specific questions that we wanted to look at that were agreed upon in this voting process. Was then followed by a literature search extensively of 37,000 articles. Following review of those 37,000 article abstracts by a minimum of two different people from the group, sometimes three, those abstracts, those study summaries, were leaned down for those included versus excluded to the full text. And then the full text of those articles were reviewed by at minimum two different people, often three. And then finally, once those articles were determined to be appropriate for inclusion, the data extraction occurred in which we looked at the specific data in groups. So there were about 30 people in the work group. We all got together for an in-person meeting and sat there and pored over all of those articles and that data as groups together, pulling out what we needed, only to then make decisions about how to analyze the data. Once the data was analyzed, so this is a lengthy process. Mm-hmm. Once the data was analyzed, we then formed groups again to determine recommendation points. And those recommendations underwent rounds of voting, really with a specific focus to every single word in the recommendation. So it was a lengthy process. It was incredibly orderly. It followed a predetermined protocol to make sure that there was really very little bias that could be employed into this.
The guidelines focus specifically on what is called MTBI, which stands for mild traumatic brain injury, which I guess they focused on that because that's the more common situation for a child.
Mild traumatic brain injury is a more clinical term than concussion.
Okay.
It reflects that there actually is an injury occurring. Concussion is a term that traditionally means lack of any type of injury seen on generally employed neuroimaging, like a CAT scan.
Mm-hmm.
However, what we know is that for mild traumatic brain injury, we don't want patients to get a CAT scan. Therefore, mild traumatic brain injury could include things like concussion, where there's no signs of bleeding or bruising or swelling on a CAT scan, but also includes those really small degrees of bleeding or bruising that are managed almost exactly in the same way as a concussion. Actually, they are managed in exactly the same way as a concussion. So for clinicians to be clear with families, we need to tell them that your child has a mild traumatic brain injury. It could be a concussion. At this point, though, we're not going to take the steps to expose your child to radiation in order to determine if there's a small amount of bruising or bleeding. That wouldn't change what we decide here today for you.
Mm-hmm.
And what we know from research is that the way that families, now this is research that's about 5 years old, though, what we know is that families are more inclined to follow instructions about returning into activities. Also, clinicians are more cognizant of an injured child, as well as coaches, when we use the term mild traumatic brain injury.
The guideline advises against traditional recovery methods, such as long recovery periods and isolation in dark and quiet rooms. Why is that? I go back to the question of what is it? Is it saying that this is for everybody? It's not recommended, or are we specifically looking at children and developing brains?
For everybody, that's not recommended.
Okay.
The reason being is that there is literature now showing us that children and adults will be likely to improve when they are able to re-engage into life rather than resting in a dark room. Perhaps resting in a dark room doesn't give you enough stimulation for an injured brain. Perhaps it doesn't encourage brain blood flow to the degree that we would like, or perhaps it just leaves someone to sit in a dark room and perseverate about their symptoms. Mm. We don't know 100% yet. There's some animal models, but we don't know definitively what the mechanism is. What we do know is that people feel good, adults and children feel good when they can get back into their activities and back into their life. And of course, that is tempered with what they can tolerate. Definitely not undergoing activities, cognitive and physical activities that significantly exacerbate their symptoms. But hopefully getting back into their activities will not exacerbate their symptoms. Hopefully their getting back into activities will actually make them feel better. And that includes physical activity that is safe. So not contact sports and not jumping on the trampoline.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention this month released guidelines on diagnosing and managing head injuries in children. We'll have a link to the guidelines at WOSU.org/allsides. The lead author is pediatric emergency medicine specialist and co-director of the Stanford Concussion and Brain Performance Center, Dr. Angela Lumba Brown. She is my guest right now. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I want to, once again, you mentioned about the developing brain and that brains are still developing upwards into the early to mid-20s. So when we're talking about children, we're talking about all the way through high school and for many, all the way through college.
Yes. Everyone should take caution. I think everyone in general, children or adults, should be aware of the behaviors they're engaging in and make an educated decision. You know, I like to say, people frequently ask me, so should I tell my child that they should not play football anymore? You know, it's a very different thing when we're talking about an adult, right? When we're talking about an 18-year-old or a college student or a 30-year-old going on, you know, they can make their own decisions about what degree of risk they would like to take. For children, we need to make a family decision based on best evidence available, making sure that we're providing families as clinicians with that evidence so they can make decisions for their family that work, that brings joy to them, and that makes them feel safe.
One thing about kids that I found, you know, as a parent, it's hard to trust their reporting. Some kids won't tell you at all that they, you know, fell off the monkey bars or the climbing, you know, rope and hit their head. They'll just walk away and brush it off. Other kids may way over dramatize something because they're embarrassed or something like that. How do you suss out from children? And I guess I'm talking about younger children now, what happened and what you need to be worried about.
For a parent, that can be very difficult. Parents, though, do have the insight to know when their child is not acting like their usual self.
Okay.
Sometimes that's the only reason they're bringing their child into the emergency room, be it from a head injury or not, is that their child is just not acting like their usual self. And clinicians give parents a lot of credit for having that insight. Usually there is something going on when a parent feels that way, especially following a head injury. It shouldn't be up to the parent to have to diagnose their child with a mild traumatic brain injury. They should be able to rely on their pediatrician or family medicine doctor or their emergency medicine clinician in order to make that diagnosis and guide them. That's why we're there. So if they did come into my emergency department, I would give that child a full neurologic exam I would look at how the child is interacting with their family, is speaking, the way they're interacting with me. Often a child who's speaking with a clinician will tell them, especially if it's a stoic child, they might tell the clinician more than what they've told the parent, or being in the ER, they might suddenly remember something or some piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. They might become more engaged rather than less engaged is what I've experienced. And what I will look for when I ask them is, do you have a headache? 94% of all high school student athletes with concussion report headache as their number one symptom. I'll ask them if they're dizzy, if they have trouble concentrating, they're confused, bothered by light, or are nauseous. Those are the top several symptoms of concussion. And then if they don't have anything abnormal on their neurologic exam, and if their symptoms are for the most part getting better or are mild, I might choose to watch them a little bit longer in the emergency department so that I can feel confident in my clinical assessment that they are continuing to improve from this injury before making a plan with the parents about sending them home.
When we talk about the guidelines advise against traditional recovery methods such as long recovery periods and isolation in dark, quiet rooms, you know, we're not talking about getting back in the hockey rink, right?
No, we're not talking about getting back on the hockey rink. So let me take that example of the patient I was just referring to, the 5-year-old who has some headache, is confused, bothered by light. I've watched them in my emergency room. They are getting better. They're almost back to their usual self. Their headache's gone away. I will talk with the family about how far they live from a hospital. I want to make sure that they live close by in case any more severe symptoms come back. Mm-hmm. I'll talk with them about perhaps taking a day off of school the next day so the child could rest if they need to. I'll give them a note for that. I'll advise them to go see their pediatrician in the next few days for a reassessment and again, to ensure that they're trending in the right direction. But I will tell them, please, though your child can get back into reading or playing or going outside and playing, no risky behavior like jumping off playground equipment, jumping on trampolines, riding a mountain bike, going back into contact sports like football or ice hockey, but also including riskier sports like gymnastics where there's a higher risk of re-injuring themselves, their head or other body part. And once we agree on a plan, I'll send the patient home to see their clinician.
We hear about the professional football players who are donating their brains to science now when they die, and they're finding the brain disease associated with repeated head trauma. Can the damages from head trauma like that begin in youth with these mild traumatic brain injuries?
Yeah, that's an important question. It's a very good question. The repeated head injuries that you're referring to that show up in later in life is called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. We don't know enough about what degree of injury in childhood could lead to chronic traumatic encephalopathy later in life. This is an area of research that is important, but that is also challenging because it means that we would ideally follow the same group of patients for their whole life. But other methods of trying to figure this out include biopsying donated brains from patients who we know have this, asking patients that we think have it about what they experienced as children. But it's really hard to tell, and at this point, I don't have a clear answer for you.
So we don't know. I mean, there's no safe. We don't know.
We don't know. We don't know what degree of impacts are safe for anybody.
And then I wondered if you could talk about why something as placid seeming as reading can be dangerous at the outset.
I don't think reading is dangerous at the outset. Tell me more about your question.
Well, because you said something like, now your kid can return to reading a book.
I'm sorry. Let me clarify. We wouldn't want the child to do anything that would significantly worsen their symptoms because we wouldn't want that child who's recovering to feel bad. Not that it would be dangerous to them.
Okay.
Not that they would re-injure themselves from engaging in activity like that. Just because if I had a migraine,
yeah.
Okay. I wouldn't want to do anything to make it worse because I would feel bad.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you also mentioned the symptom of sensitivity to light. That's, I would imagine, why one of the traditional recovery methods was a dark, quiet room. So what about that sensitivity to light? Just, again, make yourself comfortable, wear sunglasses, that kind of a thing?
Some children may have sensitivity to light, and those might be the children who have had headaches in the past, actually. If they have sensitivity to light, then, yeah, they should wear sunglasses.
Just make yourself comfortable.
Be comfortable. There's not going to be a huge proportion of patients that are complaining of this 24/7.
Okay.
This is something that likely is tied with their headache, and when their headache is treated, either by time or analgesia recommended by their clinician, that symptom will likely go away. Sensitivity to light is not a symptom that I see commonly in kids lasting for more than a couple of hours.
Okay. And are you finding that parents are more sophisticated, they are more interested in these issues than they used to be?
Yes. Everyone is more interested in these issues than they used to be. When I was 17, I had several concussions from playing basketball. You know, I was told to get up and get back into the game because we just didn't have the information that we have now. Media, scientists, parents, people who are patients themselves wanted to know more. And for that reason, we now have the extensive body of evidence that we do. There's still a lot of research to be done to answer important questions, such as the one you asked in this discussion. But this has been an exceptional increase in what we know over the last 15 years.
Barbara in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Barbara.
Kids' sports are not the only ways that kids can get their brains injured. When I was in seventh grade, the phys ed teacher used to walk from room to room on his lunch hour. He'd walk in and grab a series of boys by the neck and smash their heads repeatedly down on the desk.
Why?
Because he could, because it was fun for him, because our English teacher enjoyed his doing that.
Okay.
So when you're questioning kids about why are you acting like that, you might want to ask if any of the authorities in their school grabbed them and smashed their heads against something.
Hmm. Wow. Okay. Jeez. I have a hard time. Barbara, I believe you, but nowadays, Dr. Lumba Brown, wow. I can't imagine.
You know, falls are the number one cause of mild traumatic brain injury in children less than 17 years of age. But other important causes include motor vehicle collisions, as well as assaults. So we are not just focusing on sports-related mild traumatic brain injury like other guidelines in the past have. Mm. And that's what makes the CDC guideline so unique, is that it included research and studies among children that was not just exclusive to sports, and therefore the guidelines are generalizable to all types of injury.
Dr. Angela Lumba Brown, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Angela Lumba Brown is a pediatric emergency medicine specialist and co-director of the Stanford Concussion and Brain Performance Center, and she is the lead author of a new set of guidelines on diagnosing and managing head injuries in children. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Personality tests are fun to take, but ask a working psychologist about the accuracy of such tests, and you might hear comparisons to your horoscope. In a new report published this week in the journal Nature Human Behavior, researchers at Northwestern University identified four distinct personality types: reserved, role models, average, and self-centered. Professor of psychology at Northwestern, where he studies the dynamics of personality, William Revell, is one of the co-authors of the report. We'll post a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Bill Revell joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm happy to be here.
Sure.
Just to make sure you understand, we talked about types, but I want to make very clear that we're not dividing the world up into four separate types.
Yeah.
Because there's basically, we view, and most academic psychologists would, personality is continuously distributed on multiple dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found, and these were my colleagues, the senior colleagues in the paper, were actually physicists and engineers who did some really nice complex clustering algorithms in this high level dimensional space of personality item descriptions. And there were, and I refer to them as lumps in the batter rather than types, that there are certain parts of that region, this five-dimensional space, that where there are more people than you'd expect by chance. And you could call these types, and we did call them types.
Mm-hmm.
But most people are not in any one of those four types.
They're a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
They're spread out all over this.
They have lumps and chocolate chips and peanuts.
Yes.
What's the value of it anyway, then?
Of defining types?
Yeah.
I'm not going to argue much for types. That the use of personality in general allows us to predict things pretty well. And so predicting one dimension we use in personality is ability, and this predicts who's going to do well in school. Also, conscientiousness, which tends to predict how well you do in a job setting. Emotional stability, which predicts, among other things, risk for seeking psychotherapy. Agreeableness, which is a nice way of saying you're a nice person. And openness, which is a nice way of saying you're interested in ideas. Those broad dimensions tend to predict things moderately well, better than you'd expect by chance, and much better than you expect by chance, but not perfectly. They are reasonably there's a moderate amount of genetic variation accounted for by these dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
But then you take these, and people don't like to say, well, am I a this or a that? And the answer is no. I like your chocolate chips model. Are you a lump in the batter? I mean,
mm-hmm.
that people are distributed throughout that space. But if you don't like lumps in the batter, another way of thinking about this is people live in the United States from north and south, east and west. But there are some people who happen to live in the four biggest cities in the United States, in New York, Chicago, L.A., and Houston. But most people don't. But you can say, well, here are these quote types of people who live in New York. But if you live in Columbus, as you do, presumably,
mm-hmm.
you would not describe yourself as a New Yorker, nor as a Chicagoan, nor as a Houstonian. You'd say, well, nor is someone from Cleveland, for that matter. You say, I live in Columbus. And so saying it dimensionally, I can predict things much better about you by predicting by looking at what dimensions you would refer to,
mm-hmm.
rather than saying any particular type. That the use of that particular study was, frankly, it was a methodology paper saying how if you're doing high-level dimensional clustering, don't get taken in by lots and lots of little types. When these guys first came to me, they had like 16 types, I think, and I said that's ridiculous. That's not what the data should show. But their algorithms said, well, yes, but they're there. And any smart person can interpret any solution. And they were very smart. And they could interpret the 16 types they had.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out, if you look at it more carefully and look at random, pretty good controls, that four types tend to fairly systematically come out, just like a map of the United States, four big cities tend to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do like your chips, your chocolate chips.
All right, well, I'll let you have that one. That's
for
your charge.
I have a friend who studies analogy, and she likes my lumps in the batter. She likes my cities. I'll give her this one. It's even better.
Yeah, peanuts and chocolate chips.
So
most people are familiar with the Myers-Briggs personality test. I've taken it a couple times. One time at a management seminar, and I ranked up in this far right corner with Lee Iacocca, with an executive personality. And it was like really weird and odd. I never expected that. But you're critical of these things. So they're funny to take, and they're fun to see, but they don't, you have compared it to the horoscope in the newspaper, right?
Yeah, we have. And we actually have a website, SAPA-project.org, where we give you one of these interesting personality tests. However, we don't try to divide you into types. We try to give you continuous scores on what I described as the so-called Big Five, as well as 27 littler scales. And we give you feedback on each one of those. And this is not that complicated. If you tell me that you like to go to lively parties and everybody thinks you're lively, and I say you're extroverted, you seem to think I'm brilliant saying that, but you just told me that. And so it's not that complicated. People like to have how am I compared to other people. The type shorthand has been around with us for several thousand years, but it's not very useful. It turns out it's not very useful.
I'm kind of interested in the whole psychology of why we like to type people in the first place and categorize them.
It's shorthand.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's a coping mechanism.
Well, it's not just a coping. It's just a fast way of saying, this person is tall, this person is short. Well, in fact, most people are average.
Okay.
And height is a continuous variable. But you can say people, this person is taller versus shorter. But there is no tall type or short type. But people are happy to come up with it. It's a shorthand. And it's a convenient shorthand. And people like to do it. Partly, Myers-Briggs is very popular, partly because many people hadn't realized other people think differently than they think. And it's sort of the realization, you mean not everyone likes to talk at parties? No, some people like to be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know that. I mean, specifically the talkative people don't know that.
Well, tell us about what you did, the words that you did associate with these, reserved. Is that what most people would think of as kind of, withdrawn? I mean,
that's what's withdrawn, but the type that is sort of the largest, and once again, it's only about 10% of the population, is what we call average.
Okay.
This is not surprising. The reserved are somewhat introverted, somewhat stable, conscientious, and they're not, the labels actually came from my colleagues in physics. And role model is a nice.
Yeah, what's that?
You'd like to be stable. You'd like to be reasonably outgoing. You'd like to be conscientious, responsible, and open and agreeable. That's sort of a nice role model.
Yeah.
It turns out, luckily for you and me, many people grow into that over the years. At the other end of that is what we call self-centered, which tends to be associated with 18-year-old boys. I mean, these are outgoing, not very conscientious, and not very agreeable. These are characteristics that if anyone's ever had an adolescent boy around the house, they recognize. But people grow out of that. They change over time.
Mm-hmm. But does somebody form a more a less fluid personality type over time, too?
I'm trying to avoid using the word type.
I know.
Okay.
I just don't know what else to say.
Well, the trait.
The trait.
Many of us professional personality researchers, we use the word traits a great deal.
Okay.
And these are these stable individual dimensions. They're reasonably stable from about 18 to change your life, but they're not set in concrete. They do change. Psychotherapy reduces reduces neuroticism, for instance. And people tend to choose situations in which they thrive also. I mean, but these traits are relatively stable, but they're not set in concrete.
Is there any correlation between demographics and personality traits?
Yeah, actually there is. There are two types of demographics. One is, where do you live in the United States, for instance? And we and a number of other labs have done this, where you can look at characteristics across the United States and say, what's the personality of people who live in various states?
Mm-hmm.
And there are small, I mean, the better thing to do is look at the person, but there are these, in fact, small but systematic differences between states. And also other differences back to demographics. There are male and female differences on these, there are age differences, there are educational differences that are associated with these things. But once again, I'm trying to, if you look at the continuous variables of the big five or the little 27 that we tend to specialize in, these do show consistent patterns. And we can ask friends how, you know, to describe people, and it matches the self-descriptions pretty well. So if someone says that you are outgoing, guess what? You tend to respond that you're more extroverted.
Mm-hmm.
If other people say you cheer people up and you're sensitive to the needs of others, you tend to say, oh, I'm kind of an agreeable person. That's because other people think that, too.
Mm-hmm.
And these are fairly stable, and they do predict things. But people, and why do people want to fill out personality questionnaires?
Yeah.
Was it Plato who said, know thyself? I mean, mm-hmm. this goes back a long time. People are trying to figure out, how am I different from other people? Who am I?
Well, Bill Revell, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. Your time.
You're very welcome.
That's William Revell. He's a professor of psychology at Northwestern University, where he studies the dynamics of personality. There's a new report published this week in the journal Nature Human Behavior. Researchers at Northwestern identified 4 distinct personality traits. You can read all about it. We'll post a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening today. That's it for Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.